One of the earliest forerunners of contemporary chartered humanist organizations was the Humanist Religious Association. It was formed in 1853 in London. This group was democratically organized with male and female members participating in the election of the leadership and promoted knowledge of the sciences of philosophy and the arts. So that's a overtly religious humanist association. Then following that, we have what's called the ethical culture. The ethical culture movement founded just a year later, 1876, a few years later. It was founded by Felix Adler, a former member of the Free Religious Association. He conceived of the ethical culture as a new religion, one that would strip away the accumulated unscientific dogmas of traditional religions, while retaining and elevating the ethical message at the heart of all religions. It's just so amazing that there is still this myth that at the heart of all religions is an ethical message. You know, consider Islam, for example. The ethical message in Islam is die as a jihadist, killing those who don't surrender to Islam, and you're rewarded with perpetual virgins in paradise. The ethical message in Islam is it's a-okay for you to rape your captives. I mean, the ethical message in Islam is lying is condoned so long as you're luring your victims into becoming easier prey. The ethical message of Islam is fight them wherever you find them. The ethical message of all religions. And it's just truly astonishing that people buy into this myth that there is a unifying and good component of religion. All religion is another human construct, no different than political constructs, as whereby individuals vie for power, for control, for wealth over other individuals. It's strictly a control mechanism contrived by men to use whatever means are available to them to fleece the masses, to control the masses, to elevate themselves over others. That's the basis of every religion. Would you challenge that, Glenn, or would you agree?
Well, maybe with the exception of something like pantheism or something like that, you know.
I think there are some examples of a religion where it's not an individual vine conceiving something that enables like-minded individuals right. to vie for money and power. An example would be Buddhism.
And historically, Buddhism has had its bad times too. We all think of Buddhism as, this like, you know, mushy embrace everything, very peaceful thing. But Buddhism did have some of its very controlling times too, and leaders.
What's also interesting is that if you continue to read about humanism and its religious development within the presentation of Wikipedia, it concludes with the blending of Buddhism and humanism together to create a religion because of this ideal that, in reality, Buddha didn't speak of a god. Now, he came out of a Hindu background and acted quite religious in that background, his father being a Hindu priest. But he was trying to create a mindset that eliminated suffering. He saw life as being painful, and so his whole concept was, you know, what can I do to, or what can I profess that removes the pain out of life? And in my view, that's a wrongly ascribed goal. That
right.
we should pursue that which is good and noble and true and worthy, and if we receive a few scars along the way, they really serve to build character. So long as your goal is to actually come to know the Creator God of the universe, I'm opposed to what Buddha conceived. I think it's wrongly directed. But nonetheless, he's embraced by humanists because, of course, his philosophy was humanist. It's an example. Buddhism really is an example of a non-theistic religion.
Right. Yeah. Well, I got to the point where I just described Buddhism as the pursuit of great nothingness and Hinduism as the pursuit of the great everythingness.
It's kind of also interesting that your view of nothingness, because Buddhists are the one religious zealots that will actually achieve their goal. Those who do not accept Yahweh and the terms of his covenant, but do not lead others away from it, upon their demise, they receive the great nothingness. Their soul simply ceases to exist. So Buddhists are actually going to achieve what they sought to achieve.
Well, it's funny. Similar to the atheists, one of the leaders of a major internet atheist organization used to be an Assemblies of God preacher, but they point out, you look at these history and this violence thing, they talk about religion as being, having so many examples of being violent and wicked and that sort of thing, and point out that it's very often the non-religious or the agnostic or the average Joe's just trying to get through life who have to break the grip of the wicked religious of any ilk in order to try and bring some semblance of sanity, to life. And, it's interesting. The atheists, of course, are very often believers in annihilationism. I mean, in this nihilistic, when you die, you become unconscious.
Right. 90-some percent
in agreement with, what you say.
Yeah, exactly.
If you're saying that Buddhists achieve nothingness, you achieve unconsciousness, and you can't have any problems if you're unconscious.
Yeah. It's also interesting that this ethical approach, of course, it's not ethical. There's the ethics of humanism or political correctness, which is anti-ethics, if you will. But their driving force was to eliminate the unscientific concepts out of traditional religions. And, really all they had to do with Judaism and Christianity, for example, was to simply go back to the Torah and read Genesis, and they would have rooted all of them out. I mean, all of the unscientific claims of Christians in particular are based upon the Christian religion and not upon the text of Genesis itself.
Right. There's a lot of arguments coming from many corners where people say, hey, when we check out the Torah, it does seem to pan out scientifically.
Yeah, it's interesting here, too, that Felix Adler, in creating a religious mindset for humanism, said that he felt that the vital aspects of religion should not be allowed to fall by the wayside. Religions provided vital functions in society. That's, by the way, exactly what Adolf Hitler recognized. It's exactly what Adam Weishaupt recognized.
Groups of people who are easily controlled. You then use the ideology as a bit and bridle to lead the people around.
Right. So what Adolf Hitler did, for example, is he created a new religion. His knights and priests were the SS. It was a religious ceremony that they were brought up in, and he wrote Mein Kampf to be the people's religion. And it was a replacement religion for the most prominent religion of the day, which was Christianity in Germany. But just like Adam Weishaupt had to create the Order of the Illumes as an opposing religion to Christianity, so did Adolf Hitler. They both knew that without a religious influence in people's lives, they would not be easily controlled.
Right. And if you can get people to behave the way you want them to, you can get them to believe the way you want them to. So it doesn't matter whether you start with a belief and motivate them to action or start with you get them to act and then inculcate the belief. Either way, the agorism works.
You look at Constantine and his flirtations with Christianity. Constantine, by his own admission, never saw the sign of the cross emblazoned on the sun, nor heard the voice say, "Under this sign, conquer." He himself made it up in conjunction with his publicist years after the event, because what he found is that he could have more power over the people if he became both emperor and pope. If he wore both the religious and political title in addition to being a general, that his influence over the people, his claim to control them, was greatly accelerated. And so almost every religion is born out of a desire to control. You look at Judaism. Pharisaic Judaism is the form of the religion that survives today. You know, it grew out of a battle between Jewish religious individuals, devoutly religious individuals, who didn't like the fact that Yahweh had established the priesthood to be inherited, that you inherited it from as part of the Lowi or Levite tribe. And they didn't also like the idea that in the Torah, the Levites, having inherited the authority of being priests, could not own property, that they could not accumulate material wealth. So
separation of church and state.
Absolutely. So God said, we're not going to have this this integration. Or in fact, he's going to separate both church and state from himself. The rabbis wanted to claim that authority for themselves, and they wanted to amass great wealth, and so they created Judaism as a control mechanism. And they began to say that it is by adhering to their edicts that that a Jew achieves righteousness and therefore salvation. So Judaism was created as a control mechanism. Muhammad wanted to control the wealth of Mecca. He wanted the praise of Mecca. He wanted the women of Mecca. And so he created Islam to satiate his own cravings for sex, power, and money. And then when others wouldn't submit, he created jihadists and mujahideen to compel everyone within camel's ride to acquiesce to his new lusts and cravings for power. That's how religions are formed. The individual who was played such an essential role, Felix Adler, and creating a religious veneer for humanism, falsely claimed that all religions taught important truths. I don't think any religion teaches an important truth. I think all religions are, as we said, are control mechanisms. We've gone over Christianity, Judaism, Islam. Religions are control mechanisms that are specifically devised to empower certain individuals over others and to control them. But he nonetheless thought that religions taught important truths, and I'm not aware of them. If there are truths that are taught by religion, then certainly important ones. Albeit these truths were expressed through metaphors and were not always suited to modern understandings of the world. For example, monotheistic religions were based on a metaphor of an authoritarian monarchy, whereas democratic relationships were now understood to be the ideal. You know, I don't see an endorsement of monarchy from Yahweh. From what I can tell, when Shaul was elevated to king, the children of Israel said, we want a king like all the other nations. And God says, come on, no, you don't. You don't. Yeah, we really do. We want a big, tall, handsome guy that's a big fighter. We want our own king just like all the other Gentile nations. And God says, no, really, you don't want that. And they kept on pushing it, and God finally says, okay, all right. Yeah, you want a king? You want to see what that's like? Go ahead.
Well, God told them repeatedly what that would be like.
Yes.
All the repeated sayings that said, He shall take this. He shall take that. You know, yeah. And we're reading the compensation of the king, and it all yes. began with he shall take, and he learned all, and things just went downhill from there progressively.
Of course, you know what did all of these potentates that enveloped themselves in God and country do? They took control. They took possessions. They took money. They took lives.
Look at what the problem the dynastic succession caused when you had a king with two sons, Rehoboam and Jeroboam. You know, right. under Solomon, you have the same split that always happens with dynastic succession and two sons close in age.
Yeah, exactly. So, I don't see it that way. But they obviously promoted a difference. And by the way, I'm not a proponent of democratic ideals. The world has never had a true democracy. It came close twice with the Delian League and with Sparta. Those oligarchies, the empowered, those who owned land and had possessions, voted, and they voted almost everything. That was the whole concept of a democracy, is the people themselves legislate. And they voted whether or not to go to war. They voted on how to allocate the spoils of war. They voted on most everything. The closest we have to a democracy in the United States would be the initiative. But even the initiatives don't hold any sway anymore because a federal judge so often overturns them with one vote against the population. And the initiatives are never on the big issues of society. The people never vote on whether or not to be taxed. The people never vote on, they might vote on the amount that you can tax property, for example. But in terms of the imposition of a national tax, they don't get to vote on that. We don't get to vote on, in fact, we don't get to vote on any national referendum. So America is absolutely not a democracy. But the issue that our founding fathers had against democracy was mob rule. It's the tyranny of the majority over the minority. And so our founding fathers were hugely opposed to democracy. In fact, even in military handbooks, as the government was trying to train its soldiers, throughout the 1950s, democracy was universally besmirched. And now we deploy our military in pursuit of establishing a democracy.
It's a degenerative phase that precedes tyranny, always.
Yes, it is. They all devolve into to tyranny, which is precisely where the world at large, and particularly the countries viewed as democracies, are headed. And you know what's of course interesting is that in those tyrannies, almost universally, the people vote for their dictator. Well, the Germans voted for Adolf Hitler. In America, Americans will overwhelmingly vote for the man who will become dictator over them. And in not the very distant future. We'll be back after a moment. Back to Shattering Myths. We're considering the creation of religions, and one in particular, humanism. And this also is interesting from Wikipedia. It says, before the term humanism was even coined or even thought of being integrated into a religion, it had existed in America in at least an ideological sense for a very long time. Groups like the Free Religious Association, which was formed in 1867, and us less radical groups, mainly consisting of extreme forms of early American Protestants, such as the Unitarians and the Quakers, had existed from the very first landings of the Europeans in the Western Hemisphere. Now, what's interesting, of course, in that is that Quakers and Unitarians hold a very humanistic religion. Long time ago, I moved into a new community. It was this beautiful church that was set right on the bluffs of the Palos Verdes Peninsula. And my wife and I attended it for a while, and they were Unitarian. And it was interesting to hear the approach. At the time, I was so full of questions about all the stuff that didn't make sense in Christianity, all the myths that couldn't be answered, and all of the internal contradictions. That I was mostly, my wife and I were both there really for the just the interaction with others in the community. It was interesting to hear them articulate what was essentially a humanistic perspective, and they had songs and pageantry that all celebrated humanism as if it were a religion. The Quakers were quite similar. So there is this out of the most liberal applications of Christianity, there is a great affinity for humanism. In 1915, a Protestant defined the term. It was kind of a combination of a positivist and Protestant humanism in a magazine for the British Ethical Societies. Another Unitarian minister, John Dietrich, read the magazine and adapted the term to describe his own religion. So here's a Unitarian Christian minister saying, yeah, that humanism, that's what I'm all about. We're going to celebrate man. Dietrich is considered by some to be the father of religious humanism. In 1929, Charles Potter founded the first Humanist Society of New York, whose advisory board included Julian Huxley, John Dewey, Albert Einstein, and Thomas Mann. Potter was a minister from the Unitarian tradition. And in 1930, he and his wife, Clara Cook Potter, published Humanism, a New Religion. Throughout the 1930s, Potter was a well-known advocate of women's rights, of the use of birth control, of civil divorce laws, and an end to capital punishment. Now, the Humanist Manifesto was written to distinguish this new religion, written in 1933 primarily by Raymond Bragg, and it was published with 34 signatories. Unlike later and previous Humanist Manifestos, the manifesto talked of a new religion and referred to humanism as a religious movement meant to transcend and replace deity-based religions. However, it was careful not to outline its own creed or dogma. The document outlines a 15-point belief system, which sounds to me like a creed or a dogma, which in addition to a secular outlook opposes, now, it's funny, they've used, and you were right in criticizing me for referring to socialist secular humanism as a religion when in fact secular means non-religious. But here they are said by Wiki to embrace a secular outlook, even though the manifesto itself referred to itself as a religion and outlined
right.
Their 15-point belief system. So it sort of underscores the point I was trying to make, which is that that while most religions twist words to suit to their interests, and they are often hypocritical. And so the terms are oxymorons.
In that sense, it's definitely a religion. The Wiki author just errs in the application of the word secular, that's all. But then, of course, they end up wanting to be very humanitarian, and they view socialism as being more egalitarian. So, you know, unity, fraternity, egality, you know.
Yeah, of course.
They end up embracing socialism economically. But,
right.
Of course,
and communism politically.
Right.
And so atheism becomes the state religion of most of those communist societies. But it wasn't atheism in the sense of we're going to base this on the declaration there is no God. In the religion of communism, men became gods. If you travel through USSR, as I did before the fall of the Iron Curtain, you saw Lenin and Marx as these grandiose statues and grandiose chiseled images, godlike features with their sayings. And the sayings of Lenin, the sayings of Marx became scripture. I also traveled in communist China as the first group of Westerners that were allowed in after Nixon decided to make travel to China such that it wasn't illegal. And there, almost every billboard was a chiseled representation of Mao, which is hard to do since he had a round face, with him holding his little red book, and you saw all the people carrying the little red book and memorizing the scripture of Mao Zedong. So in these atheist societies, what they simply did is they turned men into gods.
And that's what happens, like, with Unitarianism. The difference between Unitarianism and Quakerism, with the Unitarianism, the word God is always hollow. The Quakers originally, of course, were a bit more revelatory and monotheistic, kind of like the Shakers, they quaked, But they had this massive influx of humanists, that basically transmuted Quakerism over time. And they themselves even admit this, and they also admit their historical ties to Christianity to some degree.
Yes.
But obviously the Quakerism of William Penn here in Pennsylvania and right up in where the Penn Mansion is here in the Delaware River was very different than the Quakerism of today. But just the contrast, I do want to contrast this humanism with Yahweh's guidance and human tyrannical systems and corrupt governmental systems with Yahweh's guidance. From the time of Yahweh's covenant with Abraham to the time of the anointing of Saul as king, Yahweh guided Israel by through the judges and the prophets. Mm-hmm. And, through revelation, and he wanted to be their guide, not have the king lord over them. I'm here to guide you through the judges and the prophets. After the anointing of the king, the relationship between God's true prophets and the king was often adversarial because the king was misbehaving.
Correct.
So from Saul right on down, you may be having an occasional good king like Hezekiah or something like that, but most of the time is instead of the prophet Yahweh leading Israel through the prophets and the judges listening, you have this adversarial relationship between the prophets and the king to the point that Isaiah gets sawn in half.
By the way, Glenn, the common denominator happens to be the Torah. The judges and the priests were officials and deciders on the Constitution, which was the Torah. Yahweh's very clear instructions is that all the Kohen were responsible for doing is uniting the people with God through the Torah's instructions, and the judges were explicitly told that they could make no decision that wasn't advocated by the Torah's guidance. So, the Torah was the Constitution, and the Torah has an economic element to it. That's why in Kara Leviticus, right after Yahweh delineates the path to him of these 7 days that we can meet and form a relationship with him, he then specifically tells us of his economic policy that he said, would be ideal in this kind of an environment. And, it has an element to it that is entirely free enterprise, but it does not allow the accumulation of dynastic wealth. So it was a brilliant strategy. I mean, he said, I want you to employ free enterprise, but I want you to also leave part of your fields available for those who are hungry to harvest. So they're not given the food, but they're able to harvest the food and prepare it. And then I want you to provide not money, but some wood and wool and the things that are necessary to make clothing and homes for those who need them, but they would have to engage with their own labor, though, to turn those things into useful assets. and that beyond that's how you take care of those who are in need, so that they can participate in their own sustenance, if you will. Then what he said is every 7 times 7 plus 1, every 50 years, what we're going to do is we're going to release all debts. All debts must be forgiven. All slaves must be freed. And land is returned. So you could not accumulate large tracts of land. You couldn't accumulate large wealth through the auspices of loans and banking. And you couldn't control vast numbers of people.
Right.
Well, marvelous.
Seemingly reasonable benefit package, but I think I deserve a 2-day weekend instead of just one, and a little more, you know, in the way of money.
Yeah, that's true. The DIY's weekend is a 1-day weekend as opposed to a 2-day weekend. It is, by the way, a weekend as opposed to the Christian version, which is combines the weekend with the start of the week. But the old differences between what Yahweh is suggesting and what man might covet is the basis of all political and religious doctrines, all of which are in conflict with him. Glenn, I know you need to run, but I enjoyed discussing all of these things with you today. Well, I had anticipated going to the ongoing debacle in the Ukraine. We'll return to that tomorrow. The top story amongst many news agencies is the collapse of the giant West Arctica ice sheet. They say that it's underway. They describe the melting as unstoppable and that it will cause global sea levels to rise higher than projected previously. Now, by the way, their projections on seawater rise, none of them have materialized. Their projections on global warming have not materialized. Their explanation for retreating glaciers has been proven to be untrue. But now they're speaking of these Antarctic ice sheet glaciers that are diminishing, and that their diminishment is unstoppable. Now, let's think about that for a moment. The scientists said that the sea levels are going to rise to 12 feet above where they currently are, and it'll take centuries to reach this peak, and it cannot be reversed. They said that a decrease in greenhouse gas emissions could slow the melt, while an increase could speed it ever so slightly. Warm, naturally occurring ocean water flowing under the glaciers is causing the melt. We feel that it is at the point that is, well, a chain reaction that's absolutely unstoppable. Regardless of any future cooling or warming of the global climate. You know, if it is unstoppable, regardless of greenhouse emissions, why should humanity redistribute wealth? Why should humanity change its behavior radically, go without electricity, go without transportation, go without all of the benefits of burning fossil fuels if it can't be stopped? And think about it. If all you can hope is that maybe somehow you could ever so slightly slow the inevitable, why would you go through such Herculean efforts, such economically disastrous maneuvers to do so, unless doing so was strictly a control mechanism? Now, I've shared this many times on this program. The reason that glaciers have retreated since the invent of photography around 1850 to 1875 is because that's when the Little Ice Age came to a conclusion. The Earth, for as long as plant life has existed, we have absolute proof that the Earth continually goes through 600 years on average periods of cooling followed by periods of warming. The glaciers grow, they recede based upon this global trend that is dictated by the Earth's spin on its axis, rotation in its orbit, and by systems that are long-term effects of the sun. Man has nothing to do with it, isn't contributing to it, and can't stop it. Now, beyond all of this, there is a gargantuan flaw in the reasoning of the scientists that never gets promoted at the same time that these new calls to disaster, fear, change, because the reality is that the projections by the cosmologists, those in league with the great Al Gore, they all claimed that the polar ice caps, this would be now the Arctic versus Antarctica, would be completely melted by now. Be completely melted. They said that, yeah, there'd be a Northwest Passage for the first time. They would be gone. And yet, the Arctic ice coverage is up 50%. No, it was throughout the summer of 2013, ice coverage was 50 to 60% greater than it was in 2012. It was in 2013 that all of the scientists from NASA to the Global Association of Climatologists to the Al Gore fan club all predicted that by 2013 in the summer, the ice and the polar regions, the ice cap, would be gone. And yet, its coverage was 50 to 60% greater than in the past. And the reality is, the last 17 years, the Earth has cooled. Last year, Lake Superior froze beyond any level in recorded history. We are dealing with a cooling trend of considerable proportions within a warming trend. So we have to ask ourselves, what are we doing to contribute to the cooling?